From the Sky News Centre at 6, a 41-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of terrorism offences after three people were stabbed in Manchester city centre. Tim Jones reports.
Witnesses saw police holding the suspect to the ground.
He just stabbed three people.
Moments earlier, a knifeman lunged at shoppers inside the Arndale Centre.
Someone shouting, someone's been stabbed, and the next minute she fell on the floor, and then that's when I said, like, load of blood on the floor.
When officers tried to intervene, they were targeted.
He then chased them with a knife as they were calling for urgent assistance.
Police don't know the motive for the attack, which appears to be random.
A man is facing life in jail for murdering his wife with a crowbar at stables in Cheshire. David Pomfret claimed to have suffered years of abuse from Anne-Marie, whose physical and mental health had deteriorated. Boris Johnson's latest proposals for a Brexit deal have been given the go-ahead by the EU for intense negotiations. Approval came after chief negotiator Michel Barnier held talks with Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay this morning, which were described as constructive. The daughter of the British-Iranian prisoner Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has been reunited with her father in the UK after more than 3 years in Tehran. Richard Ratcliffe has described five-year-old Gabriella as very brave. He now intends to meet the Prime Minister to try to get his wife freed.
We have been caught in the middle of a government fight. It's not our fight, we shouldn't have been involved in it, and their failure to solve it has had a huge human cost on our family. He obviously, when he was Foreign Secretary, tried to solve this issue. He went to Tehran and didn't manage it. Now he's more powerful.
Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe denies spying charges. A review is being launched into the safety of a cosmetic procedure which gives people a bigger bum. What's known as the Brazilian butt lift has the highest death rate of all plastic surgery. And World Rugby will announce at midnight tomorrow whether or not Scotland's crucial Rugby Union World Cup game against Japan will take place. It's at risk because of a super typhoon. That's the latest. I'm Nick Qureshi.
Do you want to tell original stories about Bristol and its communities?
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is North Devon prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Dawn Westacott. Former Sunday Times journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Cahill, is here too. Also, Roma Widger, you can hear her on Wednesday evenings here on BCFM. Her passion is housing. Also, Matthew Montague Pollock from Bristol Against Tower Blocks, and Paul Hazelden from Bristol Homeless Sleep Out, and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Guess what we're talking about tonight? After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, a double whammy in Syria. An Iranian tanker full of oil heading for Syria is hit by two missiles from the direction of Saudi Arabia. And Donald Trump pulls US troops out of northern Syria. Hang on, isn't that what he promised to do 4 years ago when running for president? And former Tory MP Harvey Proctor, who was convicted of gross indecency back in the 1980s, says he wants an investigation into the Met, for a bungled paedophile investigation at Westminster. He stormed out of a TV interview this week because he said impertinent questions were being asked and he wasn't being listened to. Also, the Hong Kong protests come to Bristol. We hear their slogan, which they've been teaching Bristolians to shout out to, and we speak to Bristol students Phoenix and Molly from Hong Kong. In Bristol. They're from Hong Kong. Plus the latest in the Super Brains series, one of my favourites, shortwave US radio host and former US Naval Intelligence Officer Bill Cooper. All in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 11 Celsius and rainy. All you need to do is open your window and look out to see that. But it's going to carry on through the night. This weekend, highs of 14 Celsius, rain and a few sunny spells. Next week, highs 16, more rain showers all week and occasional sunny spells. Next weekend, the 19th and 20th October, again, highs only up to about 16 Celsius, sunshine, showers and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. It's about 3 weeks we've had exactly the same weather, isn't it? So anyway, joining me to review some of this week's news is from the Brexit Party, Dawn Westacott. Hi, Dawn, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Westcott, actually.
Okay. Dawn, can you just tell us something about your background? What got you interested in politics and standing for the Brexit Party?
Okay, well, I had a career in publishing in London when I helped to launch The Lawyer magazine, and then I worked on money marketing, and that was, you know, really fantastic. And then I went into a more kind of creative editorial art direction role with magazines like Country Living, and I spent a few years at the BBC working on their lifestyle group. And then when I moved to the country and married an ex-Moor farmer, I've obviously got, you know, involved in farming on Exmoor, and we founded the Exmoor Pony Project, and I've been spending the last, you know, quite a few years helping to conserve and safeguard the endangered Exmoor ponies and promote kind of positive trust-based ways of communicating with them.
Well,
so
it sounds
quite
to me
a mixed bag, really.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a million miles away from the voters in Bristol who actually voted to remain. So what have you got to say to them?
Well, I suppose I can see both sides of it, because half of me is obviously, you know, spent a lot of years in London, working in media, working with a lot of different companies, and then the other half working in farming and working in, you know, in that community in Exmoor. And obviously, I'm an author. I've written three books about the ponies, so I do have quite an all-round view, and can come at it from different perspectives, from living in a city and living in the country. So I perhaps that's just shaped my view a bit more, because I have been fortunate to live in the country and the city. So what I would say is, it's always good to just try and look at it from all angles. And I think for me, weighing up things from as many angles as I can has made me think that we would have better opportunities outside of the EU than remaining.
Well, I mean, a lot of city people will say the opposite, obviously, from here. They'll be saying things like, well, we actually want to remain in this. It's quite a nice club. It's easy to travel around Europe. Things like the roaming charges. We actually quite like being one big country rather than splitting off and sailing off across the Atlantic into the arms of Donald Trump.
Well, I think there's a fundamental thing that really concerns me, and that is, coming back, right back to that democratic thing, one person, one vote. The reason that I'm standing as a PPC is because I can see the power moving away from individual citizens who have a vote and can have a say in this country. You know, we have a say, we have a vote, we can decide who runs this country. And as we had in the 2016 referendum, we had a choice. You know, it came right back to the people. You, the people, what do you want? And whatever you vote on, we'll enact it. That fundamental democracy is really precious. And I don't trust the EU to maintain that connection with individual citizens. I think it's all moving into too much of a centralised power, which personally I don't think
Why do you trust Westminster more than you trust Brussels? Surely these politicians are out for all they can get, aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, that's another whole thing. I think our political class and the way it's behaving at the moment needs challenging. And I think that's why people like me have come from ordinary life and we've said, do you know what? I think we don't like the way you're behaving, because once again, you're not listening to the man and the woman on the street and saying, look, they're the people who you work for. They put you there. Are you listening to them? Are you doing what they want? So, I think our political system needs to be reformed.
Well, we're going to be discussing housing for the next 10 minutes or quarter of an hour or so. But before we do that, I'd just like to ask you what you make of the figures out last week saying that Bristol is the worst place for homeless deaths outside London. Just within the last 5 years, homeless deaths have tripled in the city. Now, this is obviously very concerning. We've got a Labour administration that say that they're trying to do all they can to build houses for new people coming into the housing market, to build social housing. But the thing is, ultimately, people are dying as a result of the austerity policies coming down from Westminster, your precious Westminster.
Well, it's not my precious Westminster, because I think Westminster needs clearing out and replacing with people who can do a much better job. What I think is a big problem in this country is that not enough emphasis has been on the regions. We have not been looking at our regions. We've not been putting enough investment. We're not rejuvenating our regions. When you look at the transport infrastructure in this country, I mean, down here on Exmoor, we struggle for someone to get a bus from Bridgewater.
But haven't you all got cars? I thought you all had Chelsea tractors down there.
We haven't got cars. No, there are a lot of people. Actually, it's a big problem. I'm going to a meeting over in North Devon soon to talk about how we can improve the rural bus service. A lot of people are being left isolated. Yes, homelessness is absolutely awful, but I think it all boils down to we are not putting enough emphasis and thought and money into our regions. Far too much emphasis on London, far too much emphasis on things like this ridiculous HS2 rail link. That to make just a bit of a faster trip from London to Birmingham or whatever, when you can't get across the country. So the transport infrastructure, for a start, will help to rejuvenate the regions because people will be able to travel around better. And I think it is actually disgraceful how our regions and our places, wonderful cities like Bristol, are just not getting the help and infrastructure that they need. So I agree with all of you.
Okay, well, you're allowed to shout, raise your voice if you want to over the next 15 minutes, because we'll be discussing Bristol then. But do chip in if you feel you want to, Dawn.
Okay.
We'll start, I think, by having a listen to Paul Hazelden. And Paul, you've been for a long time, I know, working with Crisis Centre Ministries that run the free food cafe for the homeless, which is still pretty regular. But you're going to do some sort of a sleep out this evening, but we'll talk about that in a minute. First of all, why do you think there's been this enormous increase in deaths of homeless people in the city?
It's not just in the city, it's across the country. And it's not, yes, it's across the country, and I think, in a word, the answer is austerity.
Okay, so how is that actually affecting people on the ground? What does it do to people?
The services aren't there. All the support networks are being cut back. The help that people used to be able to receive is no longer available. The organisations that have been there for a long time helping people cope with homelessness and get out of homelessness, they are being under-resourced, they're overstretched, and they're just not able to cope anymore.
So what do those organisations, what have they been doing to help people who are maybe sleeping on the streets actually get a roof over their head that isn't now happening? I mean, just give us an idea of what they do. Or used to do.
The big problem is not so much finding someone somewhere to live, although in Bristol that is increasingly a problem because of the lack of homes. So you have a technical problem with there just haven't been enough places for people to move into. The problem is that the people are not able to look after themselves, to have a accommodation that they look after. They can't cope with it in all kinds of ways. So one of many issues that you face is that when you're on the street, there is a very strong community. We may not like it, we may not approve of it, there may be all kinds of problems with it, but you have very strong relationships with the other people who are there, and they are, when they're not trying to cheat you or do other things, then they are incredibly, amazingly, sacrificially generous towards each other and compassionate towards each other. And that there is a depth of relationship there that many people living in suburbia would probably kill for. And we take people off the streets for their own good, and yes, they don't want to be on the streets, and we put them in a little box on their own, and they have almost no human contact, and they can't cope with this anymore. And as a long-term strategy, that just does not work.
So what does work? What does work?
People need community. They need relationships. They need other people that they know, they trust, who will be there for them. And that is a fundamental human need. And we treat homeless people like numbers. And here's one homeless person. There's an empty house to put them in. We put the homeless person into the house and problem solved. It's not because they're a human being. And there's far more to them than just the fact that they didn't have anywhere to sleep.
Paul, the main place where people were coming across the homeless was probably, up until a couple of months ago, was the bear pit. There was a lot of people in the bear pit. Now, there was apparently a great roar of approval for the council clearing those people and the kind of shacks that they were living in and containers out of the bear pit. So that seems to me, well, I mean, certainly from the press, if they're to be believed, what do you make of that move, and why were people down there in the first place, do you think?
Well, they were there. Where do you want them to be? The reality is that there is nowhere for homeless people to gather in Bristol. There is nowhere safe. There's nowhere for them to go that would be good for them. So where do you want them to go? We'd rather they go somewhere out of the way, out of sight, where we can forget about them. They weren't actually living in the containers. The containers were actually there by people who were trying to run businesses in the bear pit, trying to make the bear pit into a good place for everybody, for families and the general population. And they were doing a fantastic job, and they were very often helping homeless people while they were there and doing an amazing job at doing it.
Sounds to me like you're saying that what the City Council have really done is to sweep this one under the carpet.
They probably didn't know what to do. There were increasing problems with members of the general population feeling threatened and unhappy about the presence of homeless people in the bear pit. They were getting complaints, and so it's understandable the council felt that they ought to do something. You can wish that something more creative and more positive could have been done rather than just clearing it. Yes, that's a long, complicated story.
Okay, well, I'm also joined by Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Now, you are helping people quite a lot doing squatting. Now, I thought squatting was actually illegal now, after Ken Clark said that you can't do residential squatting anymore, and that was back about 8 years ago.
Non-residential squatting is still legal and goes on. In residential squatting, it's a grey area. And although it's difficult to know, that will still go on, and we're campaigning against those laws.
What about the reasons for more people dying? I mean, we've heard from Paul about austerity. Is there anything you can add to that?
Well, if you make one of the answers squatting illegal, clearly people will be discouraged from fending for themselves, and they'll be out in the cold.
The argument is that you don't want to turn up from holiday, come back and find someone in your house squatting it.
That is an extremely rare occurrence. Most people want to live in a place where no one has any interest, for obvious safety reasons. So the idea that people target bungalows where people might be on holiday is an absurdity.
So roughly what's been going on in the squatting scene in the city? I know it's changed over the years from the 80s, 90s and now. Is it, has the law actually made it really difficult? Are very few people able to do it now?
Squatting continues. Most people will be squatting in non-residential places. A lot of people are now being helped in tents, caravans. They're all, of course, subject to harassment by the authorities, who say they're trying to help the homeless. And also there will be protest squats in houses that are left empty. So it continues. It takes a different shape. But people of necessity have to squat.
How many people do you think now squatting in the city, roughly? Any ideas? Because, well, I mean, it's an obvious route for some people. I see someone sleeping rough, and I will say to them, generally saying, have you thought about squatting? Most of them say, oh, no, because I thought it was illegal.
I think up to about 100, but we don't give out numbers because you're dealing with an activity that both if you like, publicly and also legally, is in a grey area, and people will not advertise themselves.
But the job is, the onus is then on the landlord to get the person evicted if they find someone living in, say, maybe an old office or something that people are squatting in.
That's true, but surely the point there is why are so many buildings still derelict, not being used, allowed to decay? This is a form of public abuse of social wealth. It should be used.
I mean, as maybe the voice of a squatter, what would you say should be done to give these people, more permanent housing?
Well, the first thing to do is to stop the persecution of the homeless by the authorities. It's not just members of the public who are maybe ill-advised or ill-willed. The authorities, just as in other parts of Europe, Hungary, are spearheading more or less a hate campaign against minorities. The homelessness are one of them. And the authorities, including Bristol City Council, should stop this. They should stop bailiffs slashing tents. They should stop moving caravans on as soon as possible. They should identify empty buildings where people are squatting and look at it with understanding, rather than just bringing down the hammer, which is what they continually have done. They've done this for the last 30 years. All administrations have behaved the same, unfortunately, and it just continues to this day.
Well, anyone that finds themselves homeless, whatever the situation that's led to it, your first instinct, I would hope, is to get a roof over your head of some sort, even if it is a tent, just a tent. You're going to be in a park somewhere, maybe. What's the situation for people like that? How does the council deal with them?
Well, it doesn't, basically. Either ignores them, or through its lesser agents, can we say, moves them on. So there is no help.
Well, I'm also joined by Matthew Montague Pollock. Now, this is a slightly different angle to all of this. We're not talking about homeless people here, Matthew, but the council has said what it wants to do is to build up. In fact, they've been quite open about that. The best way to increase the number of new houses being built in the city, and of course most of these will be totally unaffordable for the sort of people we've just been hearing. But I guess the idea here is that if there's more of the more expensive high-end houses, that some of the cheaper housing and social housing will become vacant, and that some of the homeless people can move into there. That's the theory anyway. So what do you make of this move to build upwards?
Well, personally, I think it's tragic for Bristol for very similar reasons to what we heard earlier about loneliness. You want to build communities. You're not going to build community by building a 28-floor block. I've lived in these blocks. You never see the same person at the lift shaft twice, and so you never form relationships, and you have to form all your relationships outside in work, etc. Whereas in a normal housing situation, you form relationships with your neighbours and with the other people. I live in a 6-floor flat, and I see the same people all the time, so I know these people. So that's for me one of the biggest issues. I mean, the other issue is that they are ugly. The ones which are coming up in Bedminster is being cursed with a whole lot of 22-story new blocks which have just been plonked on them by the administration without asking them, without consulting them, without anything. And these are just like the 60s and 70s blocks. I mean, they're the old sort of red brick, white stripe that you know all over the city, which just look horrible. Now, Bristol attracts people. I mean, one of the problems of the housing problem is we're relatively rich. We're a rich city. Housing is expensive. That's because it attracts people, particularly from London. If we uglify the city, we're going to lose that attractiveness.
That would be great, because the house prices will drop, surely.
That's right. They will drop. Because at the moment, house prices are something like 10 times income. So we're not like our comparisons like Liverpool where and Leeds and Manchester where it's kind of 5 times income. We're more like Cambridge and Oxford. And that's the kind of city we are.
That has changed a lot over the decades, hasn't
it?
Now 5 times, or how many times income now?
9 times.
9 times income. Now, it used to be something like 3, I believe, in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah.
So what's happened there?
I mean, there's about 7...
It seems like people are being cheated, really.
Yeah, but there's about 7 different things which was happening. Of course, interest rates have gone down, so house prices have gone up like all other assets. There's more students in the city. There's one of the things which interests me is because I'm 68 years old, is there's more old people. And as old people live longer, they live in houses. So these houses are not available for young people. Plus, we had Margaret Thatcher's privatization and the selling off of the council flats. So initially, a lot of flats went onto the market, but they've now all withdrawn. So there's many less flats available for rent, but many more people looking to rent. So in Bristol, something like 50% of young people are renting, whereas before it was much, much lower. And the rents are very, very substantial. I think the average amount that people pay as a proportion of their gross income, that's pre-tax income, is something like 40%. That's an enormous amount to pay for housing.
That's it. It is colossal. And we've got this enormous expansion of the university going on. That's also meaning a lot more of these blocks are being built for students.
Yeah. And of course, they don't have to observe the space standards. So there is an issue of what happens to them when the students go away, when we quarrel with China and the Chinese no longer come. And also, there is a serious issue of the students' welfare. Bristol University has a suicide problem, has had a suicide problem. I had a son who lived in a Manchester tower block with five other people on his corridor. They weren't of the same kind of kind. Actually, there were five Chinese, so they didn't get on. So it was quite lonely, you know. Unless you have some way of congregating, of being together, you're going to get lonely students.
So you're kind of thrown together with four random people and told you've got to get on together. Now, that could be it sounds like a bit of a nightmare scenario. Yeah. Maybe write a novel about that. Yeah. But anyway, look, we're also joined by Roma Widger. And Roma, I know you've got, so this is one of your beefs, quite rightly so too, about housing, and that you think that the decisions aren't actually made in housing about by the people who are affected by housing.
Yes, because recently I went to the Mayor's Question Time, and I can't dispute that everybody is concerned, but I could tell just looking round, I could tell looking at Marvin Rees, I could tell looking at the other people on the stage, there's no way they're going to live in the housing that they're making decisions of. They are living somewhere else, Des Res up the road. It's the rest of us that are going to live with their decisions.
What about the homelessness problem and the deaths of homeless? What do you make of that? It's something that the city has got to sort out. It really has, because, you know, this, if it's allowed to carry on, what we're going to see is more and more people not being able to afford somewhere to live, find themselves on the street, and not necessarily lasting very long with the services not there to look after them.
Yeah, well, one of my observations is we haven't moved with the times. I think there's some people that are almost like refugees, people with language and cultural problems for accessing housing, and also people like army veterans. If you're in the army and you have an accident, not on the field, but maybe you fall off your motorbike, you are out.
Okay, what about you, Kevin Cahill? I know you've written a book called Who Owns Britain, which is taking a very wide view of all of this. But what do you make of what you've heard?
I'm very glad you came to the veteran problem. The a large number of the people sleeping homeless, a large number of the deaths are of veterans, and the figures need to be broken up. We need to say why, but I'm ex-army myself. I know what happened to me. You know, intellectually, you knew what the army was. It was a place where you learned how to kill other people. So you come out of this and people think, fine, shut the door, forget it. It doesn't work. And the problems I notice tend to surface about 18 months after people leave the services. They cope for a bit, because there was discipline and things. But then you start to find people falling off the pavement, winding up homeless and then winding up dead. And people out of the services should be fairly resilient. You know, they shouldn't die on the side of the street. Something utterly awful has gone wrong. And I think one death is one too many, and people talk numbers. They forget each death matters.
Now, our Mayor Marvin Rees is really in charge of all of these things. He's a Labour Mayor, and he won't come onto this programme. He's actually quite a difficult chap to pin down. I know you said you went to, Roma, you said you went to a question time session with him. What was that like? Was it fairly, you know, could you ask whatever you wanted and maybe supplementary questions too?
No. There were about probably 50 of us. There were chairs laid out for about 200. The questions had been pre-chosen. And on the stage were his colleagues.
Hang on. The questions have been pre-chosen by whom?
Well, possibly by the Evening Post, who were sponsoring the event.
Okay.
But the Evening Post, Mervyn Rees and his supporters were on the stage. And it had all been previously decided, and they were on first name terms with a lot of the people asking the questions.
Sounds to me like a sort of press conference, really, rather than a mayor's question time.
Yeah, I mean, you can't dispute the way that they want things to work, but I don't know if they're really in touch with the grassroots.
Yeah, reality check, maybe.
Reality check.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Marvin, because occasionally you can catch him on Facebook Live, because that event you were talking about wasn't recorded, but he did some sort of Facebook Live discussion where he picks some questions and answers some of them, and it is immensely long, but I've taken a little clip of it where he is here talking about his plans for the Western Harbour. Now, this is the big vision for housing in the city from our so-called Labour mayor, is to build big and build in the Hotwells area, and this is how he plans to do it.
Florence Trightingale McGee, why won't the council allow the public consultation on Western Harbour on all the options? Okay, so I must admit, Florence, that there's a degree in which the kind of some of the voices around Western Harbour have been quite interesting to watch. First of all, let me just set out the context to Western Harbour, because it feeds into these questions of motivation, because some of the commentary on this may ask questions about my character, my motivation, my ego, and all these other things that that people are suggesting are suspect and so forth. This is the context in which we are working. Bristol has a housing crisis today. The city's going to grow by 100,000 people over the next 20 or so years. We have to deliver homes. 12,000 people on the housing waiting list, 500 families in temporary accommodation, young people coming out of the care system, the need for homes for older people, adaptable homes in balanced communities that we don't have sufficient stock of, the need for move-on homes for homeless people coming off the streets, and homes for people looking to downsize so we can free up larger homes for our families. We have a housing crisis, and we have to deal with that. We also have a climate emergency. And that means that we got to think about, as the city develops, how do we minimise the impact of that city development on the climate? How do we minimise our carbon footprint? What that means is we have to build in the middle of cities. We're building right across Bristol, but we do have to take advantage of city centre locations, because that reduces car dependency. The Western Harbour site is a 7-minute bike ride and a 25-minute walk on average from major employment zones in the middle of the city, retail, entertainment, and so forth. So, and it's on a public transport route. So in terms of sustainability, both in the quality of homes built and its location, that meets those challenges. We have other issues as well. We need to introduce flood defence. We are at increased risk of the 1-in-100-year flood, so we've got to put flood defences down there. All cities are facing a challenge to their city centres. We need to put life closer to the city centre to protect, so our cities don't end up hollowed out if department stores leave and so forth. That keeps the cities alive. So we have to proactively put people in there. And we need to create spaces for people to come together. And we believe our waterfront is a fantastic space. We believe the current road network robs us of that waterfront. People aren't sitting having picnics underneath the flyovers. And we can bring that back into, we can do all those things at the same time. What's happened is we've had, this scheme has been talked about for some time. We've had some initial work done on moving the road. It's not because it's a road-led scheme. It's just that the road network down there is the thing that dominates that part of the city. So it needs to be moved. That will free up the land for us to bring forward the homes and the retail and the amenities that will need to go there. That's what we're doing. We went at the earliest possible opportunity to get that early feedback. The three options put out there are the feasible options. We will share all of the options that Arup looked at when the report comes out over the coming weeks. So it's not some kind of JFK level conspiracy. I promise you, it is literally that these are the three most feasible options.
So that's the Mayor, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees there, speaking on a Facebook Live about his plans for the Western Harbour. Now, I guess what he's planning here is some sort of trickle down, so that as people move into these wonderful new houses at the Western Harbour, Matthew, then the whole housing situation eases in the city.
A lot of what Marvin was saying is reasonable, but one wishes he could share information more. What he lacks very much is the ability to go out and consult with other people and talk to other people around the city. Does he really not think that there are people in the city with the brains to look at these 10 scenarios which are drawn up, to have the facts presented to them and come back to him and say, well, this works and this doesn't work? Why does he have to keep it so secret? Why also does he not draw up some kind of housing plan before the motorway? The plans, all three scenarios, and particularly the scenarios which have motorway on the southwest side, are really unacceptable. I mean, you're losing that fabulous green space which is so vital to Southville, and which you go out any day of the week, and particularly at weekends, you see families and children with their dogs kind of gambling, all that. To have that covered over with a motorway, it makes no sense to me.
Ben, what the mayor is planning here in Western Harbour, is it going to help squatters, homeless in the city, do you think?
Well, I don't think it'll do anything at all. It does seem a little bit to one side of what's needed, which is to provide spaces where people can maybe even make their own homes. But also, it does seem to be more of the same of harbour development, which has already happened. And that seems to have made no dent on
So if you were in his shoes, what would you like to hear him? What sort of policies would you like to see coming out of the mayor's office?
Well, I do think Bristol City Council have a problem because they have a budget problem. But one of the things they should do is keep social provision, public toilets, libraries, all the things that they're so busy cutting. The other thing they ought to do is to identify smaller sites. There is a smaller site to the south of the Western Harbour development. I think it was an old stone yard and railway yard. Now, this kind of smaller site could be used, specifically targeted to people who won't be able to afford a high-end flat. And they're not really looking at solutions for homelessness. As was said before, you can't just bung people into houses without considering that there's a community. And they're not even making properties for people who are on very...
And I guess you'd also suggest that they lay off the homeless people. I mean, maybe even have designated parks where there might be some portaloos, things like that, if the public toilets have been closed.
Well, that's true, but why don't they're in a crisis. Now, in a crisis, you don't just carry on. You adapt and create new ideas. One of them would be to work with homelessness organisations and ask them what they think can be done right away. It could take, I think, it would probably take about £20,000 at most to get rid of the whole problem of people on the streets. It could just be done very straightforward.
Spent on what?
You could spend it on immediate emergency accommodation, caravans, even tents, portaloos, everything designed as if you were in Syria or somewhere. You know, they don't go on about building council houses in the war zone. They make refugee camps.
Well, now, actually, the council is trying to move all the caravan people out of the city. They had a massive clear-out recently.
Well, that's true. This shows you their priorities. Trickle-down hasn't worked. It's never worked. It's not designed to work. It's really trickle-up, where money goes up to the rich and the poor are left on the pavements, literally. It never works.
Okay, so for Bristol Housing Action, if people are interested in finding out more about squatting, how do they do that?
Well, they can either contact us on our phone number, 07833 100 399. They can come to the drop-in at PRSC People's Republic of Stokescroft, Jamaica Street, on Tuesdays 2 to 4, or we'll find them, because we do regularly walk around, and unless you're blind, you'll always run into homeless people.
You certainly will, despite the greatest efforts of the City Council in the bear pit. Before we speak to you, Paul Hazelden, finally, Matthew, before you go, I'd just like to say, like you to share with us what you make of the government rejecting the spatial strategy for the South West, which seems to be a bit of a blow for this is actually an enormous kind of planning thing which every region of the country goes through every once in a while. Central government, I think it's called the Planning Inspectorate, has thrown it, I'm afraid, quite politely, as politely as they can, back in the mayor's face and other people's. They're saying that actually you just simply haven't got a plan that's going to work.
Well, if you read the inspector's report, it's quite funny, actually, because they find so much wrong with what Bristol City Council put in. And it is the first of this level of inspectorate, and it's vital to all the other plans which go underneath it. The joint spatial plan is the top-level plan, and everything else falls if that falls. Now, it seems to me that the inspectors really wanted to get it right because it was the first one of its kind, and they were insisting on the logic being strong. And Bristol City Council was in no way prepared for this. It didn't realise it was going to face a real proper examination, and it had just shifted all this housing it wanted to put around Bristol out, some of it beyond the Green Belt, some of it in other places. There was no rhyme or reason to it, except in some places there was a rhyme and reason that it was near this thing. So the arrangement was going to cause enormous amount of traffic going to and from these really distant places. So the inspectors came down really hard on this and said, well, we want reasons and logic for all of this. Please, come, take all this away.
So what they're saying basically is no blather, please.
No blather.
Explain yourself.
Dismantle the whole thing, find reasons and follow the logic and come back to us. So that's a big work.
It's a bit of work in progress up at the mayor's office, I imagine. Thanks very much, Matthew. And if people are interested in your campaign, how do they follow that?
Thank you.
How do they find you? Tower Block
on the web, there's lots of things. There's a Facebook site called Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks, and there's also a website for the same thing. Just put in Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks, and you will find the Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks.
Now, surely the most hardcore amongst us tonight, anyway, is Paul Hazelden, who's going to sleep rough out on the sleep out. Can you tell us, Paul, why you're doing that?
Well, it's the Bristol Homeless Forum are organising a sleep out on behalf of the major organisations working to help homeless people in the city. We've been doing it, the first one was about 11 years ago, and it's been basically an annual event since then. So the point is partly to raise sponsorship for the charities that are doing this frontline work. It's partly to raise publicity, to heighten the issue of homelessness and to identify the scandal of our people being homeless in this sort of weather. And we've got volunteers doing it out of choice because they care, but there are so many people who are being forced to sleep homeless on the streets and in inadequate accommodation night after night because the alternatives are just not there for them. Okay. And that is wrong.
So if people want to find you tonight, where are you going to be?
Well, it's what used to be called Pip and Jay. It's now Central Church, and we'll be in the churchyard there. If you want to find out about it and about the charities taking part, then Bristol Homeless Forum is the website. If you Google us, then it's bristolhf.org.uk. You'll find us there. Could I say just a few words quickly about the statistics on homeless people dying? The actual numbers recorded are just over 700, which is astonishingly low. So the actual figures are not actually that reliable. The ONS say that the figures are, I think they say, reliable, but conservative. So they are certain that number of people, homeless people, will have died. the real numbers could well have been much higher.
And that's a national figure.
And that's a national figure. Yeah, the if you just look at the number of people who we know have homeless people who have died in Bristol, the figures just don't tie up. To give them their due, Bristol Council are keeping some sort of list of homeless people who die. But I was looking at the list just earlier today, and the reality is that most of the people on their list, either the name or their age or the date when they died was wrong. So the figures we have are just not reliable.
Well, I've also noticed that some of the hostels are just simply not informing the council when people die, yes. And there's been evidence of that as well. Anyway, Paul, thanks very much. Yes. So that's Paul Hazelden from the Bristol Homeless Sleep Out Tonight and the Homelessness Forum, Matthew Montague Pollock from Bristol Against Tower Blocks, and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Thank you all very much for coming in. We'll come back to you, Roma. You think that many of the problems in the city, all sorts of things that are wrong in the city, can be traced back to homelessness.
Yes, because one of the questions that was asked at the mayor's question time related to education. Somebody said, "What are you going to do about education?" Well, of course, the answer to that was more teachers. And the person who was helping Marvin Rees to answer this question was indignant at the audacity of teachers that were trained in the city and then left. Well, I can tell him why, because if they go up country, maybe up to, Nottingham, for example, they can get a house affordable on their salary. But we've got a shortage of nurses, bus drivers, teachers, public section workers. They just don't run to the rents and the mortgages in Bristol.
But what can we do, Kevin? I mean, you've been working on this topic for a long, long time, haven't you?
Make more land available would be the...
Well, that's what the council have tried to do, but the planning inspectorate have said, no, you haven't done it right.
I think the first thing is that there's a myth that land is scarce in England, and the key thing is it isn't. So you need a proper register of what land there is. Get the facts. That's the first thing. Don't try and build on brownfield sites when there are fallow acres, probably quite close, and currently being propped up by subsidies. If acres can't earn their living, then build houses on them. It won't destroy England. There's no danger.
Roma, I also noticed you've got your own little programme that you've drawn up, which is, you know, what would you do? I have to ask you, if you were in charge, if you were sitting in the mayor's chair, what would you do?
There's two things. First of all, to make more houses available. That would, for example, limit the number of houses that are owned by landlords, because we've got numbers of council houses here that have been bought up willy-nilly, full scale, and individuals are now sitting on their laurels and people are renting them, and you know, they are judging and setting the rents for Bristol. That should be stopped. And then there's the emergency programme, which is something different. Now, an emergency programme will probably involve caravans, the caravan people. They're not gypsies, they're not Romanies, they're not members of the caravan club. They're living in caravans. And you can see that that can be done in a way that is acceptable to neighbourhoods.
You know what? I've seen a lot of people who just simply can't afford rent. They go into either canal, boats, things like that, anything. They'll find somewhere to live that isn't costing them £1,000 a month.
Yeah. Well, in Amsterdam after the war, it's a different circumstance, but people were desperate and homeless and they lived in boats. And the idea is that they live in the boats and it's all managed. There's some sort of substructure, there's sewage, there's all the stuff that you need, and it's laid on for the boats. And lots of people in Amsterdam still live in boats. Now, we could do something similar with caravans.
Well, we've got a bit of water here, haven't we?
Well, I think actually the boat thing in Bristol may be a tad too far. But we've got spaces where you could put numbers of caravans. But what people don't want, they don't want something like a third world refugee camp on there. doorstep, but they don't mind a few people living in caravans in sites which are otherwise just laying to waste.
You know, you've said it all there. In a way, what we're doing is we're heading towards a third world situation here, aren't we? And, you know, there seems to be that the authorities are in denial about it.
They're in denial. And do you know what makes me even more speechless? And that's why people are saying, why are people dying on the streets? Would you like to sleep out in the gutter tonight? It's cold, it's wet, it's October. By January, this will be unbearable.
Well, fair play to Paul. Well done, Paul. Anyway, we're still joined on the line. You're still there, aren't you? This is Dawn Westcott from the Brexit Party.
Yeah.
Dawn, what do you make of what you've just heard? I mean, you do have obviously quite a lot of experience of city life. And also, you know, you can see the problem we've got in the city.
I can. I mean, it's absolutely heartrending. Is Paul still there?
He's gone now.
Oh, he has gone. It's just that I was really interested in what he was saying about the bond and the camaraderie in these in the homeless communities, and how when you take someone who is in a bad place in life and has all the stresses and horribleness of being homeless, taking them and putting them into an isolated room or he called it a box, and taking them away from that community, so that even though those communities can have their risks, there is that incredible spirit, and it is giving them something really important, and they can't cope when they're just isolated. And I really wanted to ask him what he would really like to see. Obviously, all of the other considerations, and I've heard all about what Roma said and what Matthew said and Ben and it is and Kevin, really. What do people really want to see?
I think the main. Oh, okay. So we're talking about very basic accommodation, and people are not asking for a whole lot. I mean, things like there's a program in a city to build containers in caravans, this sort of thing. Just anything.
But, how do you preserve? How do you give them shelter, but enable a strong community to continue so that people can have that connection, that kind of, that relationship, that community that keeps them going through really hard times, and also where they can source the help and support that they need to get into a better place.
Well, no, we'll have to leave that because Paul's not here to answer it, but I've done my best to answer. I don't know, did you hear the question, Roma? No, you didn't. Okay, sorry. Kevin, any thoughts, Kevin?
It's trying to solve an informal problem with formal council bureaucracy. Never works.
Yeah,
it just makes the problem worse.
Anyway, look, we ought to also talk a bit about some of the other stories this week. One, of course, is Brexit, and we've got the Brexit Party on the line. Well, what do you make of the current state of affairs? I noticed one of the stories this week that popped up for me, Dawn, was that we can't trust you, apparently, not to use the period of an election campaign to drive our country off a no-deal cliff edge that will crash our economies, destroy jobs and industries, cause shortages of medicines and food, and endanger peace in Northern Ireland. That is Jeremy Corbyn. Now, he's actually talking about an economic crash. He's now saying that he believes that will be the result of Brexit if we go out with a no-deal on the 31st of October, Dawn.
Well, I think he's just nonsense, and I think we've just got to stop listening to him, because all this propagating of Project Fear and terrifying people and trying to say we can't stand alone, that the UK is just useless, we can't govern ourselves, and we should keep pouring money into the EU and moving away from this fundamental, important democracy of one person, one vote, is just nonsense. I think it's actually really irresponsible. And I think that's why all the way through our country, we have seen, we've got regions in trouble, we've got a transport system that's rubbish, we are just in a mess. And I think we've just got to take the reins back up, take control back, manage ourselves properly, and I think everyone will be in...
Sorry, we've lost Dawn there. We'll see if we can get her back. But anyway, Kevin.
No, I was only going to say, Dawn, can you count? Have you got an O-level in arithmetic? A farmer, a milk company in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. If there's a no-deal Brexit, currently they send millions of gallons of milk to the Irish Republic. It takes 400 forms a year. The day of a no-deal Brexit, that turns into 1,200,000 forms. How can that be progress? It's not Project Fear. That's ridiculous.
Sorry, Roma, what do you make of this, Jeremy Corbyn? And is it Project Fear or not?
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn is sadly disillusioned. I think, you know, one way or another, the paperwork will just have to be dealt with.
No, it won't. Because it can't be. That will cripple the company. It's dead.
Yeah.
There's no dealing with it. And you really got to get sensible about this. And count.
So, economic crash, do you think that's going to happen then, Kevin?
Well, I've given you a sample. And this is going to happen all over Britain. There are loads of our companies that are on marginal, you know, the profit is, say, 10% or something. That will be wiped. And it's not Project Fear. That's a slogan. It means nothing. And it's a total insult.
I mean, what about these? Most of these food companies, they're actually selling stuff within the UK. They're not exporting it or importing it. I mean, there's a lot of it is just within the UK, surely.
Well, apparently about 50% of our food is imported from somewhere, from either Ireland or the continent.
The thing is, although we import a huge amount of food, we also export a huge amount, and we'll just have to stop exporting and eat what we've got.
Well, if that worked, that's what we would have done, because it's cheaper.
Okay, what about the fact, apparently we were told this week, that Britain must pay billions into the EU budget, even if there's a no-deal Brexit? Brussels finance chief is warning us, because they have a serious problem. Talking about going bust and economic crashes, the euro is going to be in all sorts of trouble, and the European budget. What do you make of that, Kevin?
They'll just have to write a new budget, and it'll be a poorer budget for all of us. Those people who talk about Project Fear really are lying.
Maybe, though, it is a bit of a cosh to make sure that we do get something better than we're being offered. If we don't pay, they won't get it.
Well, if you belong to a club, you usually have to pay your fees.
Yeah,
that's normal.
But when you withdraw with bad feelings, sometimes you just don't.
We can't.
It's a bit again. Going out of your rented accommodation without paying your deposit, isn't it? Or taking your deposit or whatever, and landlords in that sort of situation.
You know, and here's the other problem. There is no such thing as, in effect, a no-deal Brexit, because we will try and go on trading. Our companies will go on trying to sell stuff in Europe and buy stuff from Europe. That is as mythological as Project Fear.
Yeah.
There's a reality, there's a practicality, and the danger is enormous.
Okay,
the country won't collapse.
Have you got a final word on this, Dawn? Can you hear me, Dawn? No, she can't. Okay, so we've lost her completely. Anyhow, we've pretty much come up to the 7 o'clock news now, anyhow. So thanks very much to our guests in the first hour. That was Matthew Montague Pollock from Bristol Against Tower Blocks. He seems to think that there are two different policies here in Bristol, one from Nicola Beach and one from Paul Smith, which aren't really compatible. Also, Paul Hazelden from Bristol Homeless Sleepout and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Roma Widgell, we'll see, she might be staying for the second hour. But anyway, it's time for the Comcast News, the US-owned Comcast News at 7 now.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.